session. I can see out the window that people are still coming and going, and that maybe that some others will come and join us. But you have been faithful in rallying to the call of the bell and coming here, and at least by my watch, it looks like it's 10 up. So we'll begin. I want to say that I am Patricia Lull. I live in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I am one of those foolhardy people who thought that the absolutely best way, most authentic experience to get me to Holden Village for this first visit would be to drive. And I have. And I want to tell you, there's a lot of country between here and my home in St. Paul, Minnesota, but it's been a great revelation, a great adventure and experience, and I hope not only in today's session, but as meals and some time coming and going would allow, and then throughout the week for those of you who are staying on and who will be back with us, there'll be a chance to get to know one another a bit more. I want to say, take a little time here on Monday to introduce what we're doing, and that means that today will be slightly different than the rest of the week for those of you who are able to return for sessions. I was so thrilled when I heard the theme about this treasure in clay jars, and that has its own depth and beauty and resonance that we are hearing lifted up in worship and in a whole variety of contexts. But no sooner had I heard the word treasure than that old mystery hunter in me was off on a quest. So there's another passage, and I think some of you have carried in Bibles. If somebody'd be willing to look up Matthew 13:44 and just read that, that'll kind of be our opening, and then we'll have a word of prayer. And I think you know, those of you who were in Romans, or those of you who've been here at Holden before, or hear it from me now, first one to begin reading gets to be the reader. Just, and don't worry if you tread on somebody else's voice, just plunge in. Matthew 13:44.
The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found and hid again. And from joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field.
Thank you. We're going to be talking about discipleship for the sake of the world in these five sessions. This is just a masterful parable that I think fits well with being at Holden Village. And I would encourage you, one of the things to take forward from our time today is to mark down that Matthew 13:44 and begin to let it have some play in your own imagination about treasures and fields and buying and getting in on a good deal. In the church, we do not always use that language when we talk about discipleship, but I want to tell you, discipleship is a good deal and it comes from God. And over the course of our five sessions, we'll look back at what kind of treasure in the field. There are five themes I've picked, and I tried to pick things that would already be familiar to you. This is not arcane discipleship. I think if we were spending the winter together in Holden and knew we would have much, 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 much time together, we might go off the beaten path and tackle some more obscure things. But I wanted to try to choose themes where you'd say, well, I already know something about these. And I'm counting on that so that you can enter the participation of this. Today we're going to eventually look at vocation from one particular angle. Tomorrow prayer. I think we have a break on Wednesday from this particular gathering. So in the third session on Thursday, neighborliness, kind of forgotten aspect of discipleship in our world. Then pilgrimage, and then Saturday morning ending up with service. Now a little bit more about me before we take time for you to find out a little bit more of the people about the people around you. I consider myself a contextual theologian. I don't know if other people consider me that, but that would be, if I had to claim a discipline. Now, I'm not very disciplined, but that's what I would categorize my work and thinking and a lot of my teaching. And there are two things I would say about being a contextual theologian, because maybe you're one too, and maybe you didn't know there was a title for your way of being a theologian. I am just incredibly curious about what God is doing in the world, in other people's lives, and I have to admit, pretty curious about God in my own life. So if curiosity is part of your theological passion, you too might be a contextual theologian. And then secondly, what I like to do as a contextual theologian is create environments in which other people can use their skills and resources and curiosity to also wonder and ponder and put language on what God is doing in their world. Thus, the participatory nature of this class. That's what contextual theologians do. Because we have only an hour, and I will say, when it comes to time management, I work at Luther Seminary where almost always teaching is in a 3-hour block. So the 1 hour, I was kind of relieved that you don't have to have a break. You know, we're instructed to make sure that those bathroom breaks anytime we're doing a 3-hour course. But I'm not sure I quite have the rhythm of 1 hour down. So we'll see how things spill over from day to day. But one of the ways that we can make the most of time is I would like you, and you may need to move if you've sat too close to your familiars. You already know plenty about them, and you're allowed to move a little bit. I'd like to give you about 3 minutes to be very noisy and to see if you could begin to explore a question with a couple of people around you. And that might mean just one other person or two other people. I'll make enough noise to call us back together. And what I would like you to do is share your name, so at least your near neighbors have at least a name to call you by, and what it is that you see in your time at Holden. Okay? Thank you for being willing to plunge into a more communal experience. And I will say, from not only the small group I joined, but the level of conversation, I think we are good for one another. There are 3 things that I hope to accomplish in these 5 sessions on discipleship. The first is to explore 5 big questions with you. I know I've met at least one person who's leaving. This is the only day, leaving tomorrow. And so I want to say, I believe in spillover assignments. There's take-home work. There are projects you can continue. And the reason I believe in those so much is that this treasure in the field and a life of discipleship is really lifelong. So it's great the more we can gather with some continuity this week, but also this is a portable conversation. And maybe you have found some conversation partners that you can continue this work with in your time here. But if not, find someone at home who can pick up the conversation with you. I'm going to send handouts around. And again, these are questions to live with for the whole week and the whole month and the whole year and maybe for a lifetime. I know there are plenty of copies and they'll come around. I want to just say a couple of words about these questions. Contextual theologians pretty much have the conviction, at least within communities of faith, that all the resources we need have been provided or could be provided. We live in a world sometimes with economic crunches going on where we think, well, it's going to be really hard for that group over there. They won't have what they need. And boy, there's going to be a buffer around this other group. You can decide which one you're feeling you're more aligned with these days. But in God's economy, there is always enough for what is needed for hearty and robust lives of discipleship. And so the questions are for you to consider some are very personal, and you may not yet have that group of people with whom you can share them, but I think God will show you that group of people. Or you may be going back to a whole community of faith, and you can just copy these. I would encourage you to revise them, make them even better in your home setting. But these kind of five questions. The first one is what I really consider an orienting question about discipleship making a profound difference in the world. Discipleship also shapes how we are within communities of faith, but I think enough already on that. And particularly for many of us deeply enriched by our Lutheran theology and Lutheran experience, sometimes getting to the threshold of the door and taking a step out is the bigger challenge. So I just put number one as an orienting question for you in each of our communities of faith. And a community of faith might be where two or three are gathered, or it might be that so-called congregation back home. Some of you have profound responsibilities. You're glad to be away for a week with other people bearing those responsibilities. Community of faith, I think in the 21st century, we have to admit, could be a circle of friends where nobody is giving you nonprofit status. Nobody's calling you church, but you know you are a community of faith. And so the question is, in whatever configuration, what profound difference in our world that so needs the impact of the Christian witness and the Christian movement. A couple of questions about environment, because discipleship doesn't just happen. There's a whole context around it, supports, encouragement. And I like question three, for those of you who do have the courage to belong to a congregation, and to claim that a congregation belongs to you. Just some honest conversation about what's expected in terms of discipleship. And if it's hard to come up with anything, you might want to spend a long time on question three. Should it be that way? Question four and five are both more personal, because sometimes we are the person in search of that community of faith. So you can take them in any order. And again, the sheets are yours. And most importantly, the working on those questions is your unfolding homework from today. The second thing we're going to do, we've already accomplished, we're going to do some peer-led learning, and that means that you have as much to say to each other, and certainly to me, to enrich the wisdom that we carry forward from these sessions. And then, I thought this up back home, and I hope it is a metaphor that stands. I would like to unearth more questions than answers, and then here's the risky part for those of you who know more of the history of Holden. To discover more ore veins than nuggets. And I think that's how it worked with the mines here. What was first discovered was not just one little mineral, but the fact that there was something much more expansive. I think discipleship, the treasure in the field, is realizing you're really onto something that's going to grow and lead you in new directions. But some of you can help me with my mining metaphors and whether I have that down there.
I can do it right now.
Yes. Please, Larry.
There's no gold nuggets up there.
Okay. There was some gold in the main.
The time the gold occurs is in parts per million distributed. So we are all distributed in this.
Excellent. Thank you, Larry. I want always to have a geologist with me, because both biblically but also in the landscape of American culture, so many of the richest metaphors are to be found with a geologist yourself. I want to take about 10 minutes to talk about my understanding of discipleship. But you're not required to share it. I would really encourage you to improve a definition. I put one on the board. I'm not particularly wed to the definition. When I teach classes on discipleship, one of our tasks in coming together is for each member of the class to come up with a definition of discipleship. And so please, if you want to in any way, take this. You can cite that I said this was my working definition today. But even better, take it and improve it and make it work better to encompass what you mean by discipleship. But for today, this is what I would say. Discipleship is a way of life in which we point to the gospel of Jesus Christ with the whole of our lives. And I want to just comment on a couple of the phrases. And I think as we have, as our time together unfolds, we can come back to some of this. Doesn't this have Dorothy Bass's name written all over it? Way of life, along with not only Dorothy, but persons like Craig Dystra, Chris Sharon, who was up at Holden a little bit earlier this summer, Martha Stewart, who teaches at PLTS, a whole Jean Rabbani, who's here with us, who was on teaching staff last week, beginning to speak of way of life. They aren't the first to use the phrase or the concept, but I like to honor those I borrow from. So I deliberately wove that into this definition, a whole way of life in which we point to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Perhaps some of you have also traveled to Mexico or Central America, as I have. I lead seminarians to Guatemala each January, and one of the things I've begun bringing back are santos, and had I not needed to pack so frugally, I would have brought a santos along, kind of folk art wooden sculptures. The very first one I bought, carved from a single piece of wood, is doing this. And the hands were movable, so when I brought it home, it was a pointing. I think it's St. Andrew pointing. And that's just been just an important icon for me, not to be the gospel, but to point to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then the reason I added the phrase, with the whole of our lives, I think we're learning more and more in our culture, in our own lifetimes. It's not about what we do on Sunday morning or evening, depending upon your worship style, but it's with the whole of our lives that we point to this gospel of Jesus Christ. That's my working definition. Comments you want to make about that? Please, Larry.
You have to be careful when you point. You're not telling somebody what you must believe. The pointing has to be in yourself and Christ.
Yes, and that the object is toward Jesus Christ. It's very helpful that it's not some of us have it and other people better get on board. And again, think of the richness of that metaphor of the treasure buried in the feel. That's a more provocative image about treasure hunting for many and not just for one small group. Please.
Just to, Larry, to kind of bounce off that idea of pointing, when you use that word pointing, I'm thinking of compass and true north. So that's an orienting.
So an orienting. Thank you, Mark. Yes?
There's also the saying is when you point to somebody, there's three fingers pointing back at you.
And again, you may have a way of coming at this definition that will actually enrich us, and I would invite you, as we gather in future sessions, we'll have some news, it's now called a flip chart, some of us generationally still call it newsprint. We'll have some ways for you to display if you come up with a definition so that we can be enriched by those. But I do want to hold to five things that at least right now are quite important to me when I think about discipleship, and they're the smaller points here. Discipleship rests on God's call and sustaining presence. We don't dream up discipleship. We've all, maybe in reflecting on our own lives or thinking of others we've watched from some distance, seeing people become just hot on a cause or an issue, all fired up and passionate. But theologically, we always want to say of discipleship that it's in response to God's call. And this, I want to emphasize the second part, particularly for those of us who travel to Holden, and God's sustaining presence. I suspect that a number of you, when you were answering, what do you see, you've come for a place of rest and renewal. And so just right from this first session to be reminded that not only God has called you to a way of life, but God sustains us in that way of life over a whole lifetime. And that includes some weary and dry seasons. That includes times of transition and change. It includes times of real joy and surprise as well. Secondly, that way of life is more about faith practices than rules. And again, I've mentioned some of the leaders in that way of life, faith practice movement, and one that's so dear to the heart here at Holden is Dorothy Bass. And we'll be examining some faith practices. You have all kinds of faith practices. Just being at Holden, I think for many of you, you'll say, well, I hadn't thought of it maybe in quite those terms, but it's part of your faith practice. Thirdly, discipleship is always communal. I want to acknowledge that there are seasons when it's very lonely and solitary. I think we find plenty of evidence in the scriptures that it was that way for Christ himself, but also for the disciples. It comes back to being a communal experience. Fourth point, that it's always oriented toward the other. And I think a couple of you have picked up on that language. It's not about me and my faith, and I've got it right, and the rest of you better get on board. But discipleship leans into the needs of others. And in a little while, we're going to talk about vocation. A lot of the conversation in our culture, including church culture, about vocation is all about me and my gifts, and that's part of the equation. But what about the needs of the other? Where does our vocation lead us there? And then a fifth point, there are really many right models, and so you're not going to hear all that much about my experience. There's one or two stories that I want to share, because I'm far more curious. I already know my experience. I'm curious about your experience, and you ought to be more curious about your experience than mine. We can be a touchstone and a springboard for one another, but finally, it's to our own homes that we return. Of those many right models for living discipleship as a way of life, four features. One is contextual, and that means what's real for you where you live. And you can think of you in the plural sense, for you and your folk. What's real? Secondly, both local and global, there's always something about communities of faith that are about real neighborhoods, but also about the wider world, including a much wider world. Really like the language of improvisational, which means not a one of us has lived in the year 2010. It's future for all of us. And so even some of the things that we're putting together now to make sense of our lives as people of faith. I just think what I see on the horizon is 1 year from now, there will have been some surprises, and we'll say, okay, now I've got to improvise in yet a different way. And improvisational is a very hopeful term because it suggests that the God who calls us and sustains us can help us find that way to be have vitality not only for our own lives, but for the sake of the world in decades we haven't even begun to imagine. And then I just have to say this as a Lutheran, discipleship, it's always reforming in our context, which means none of our home places have we gotten it right for all time. We have to keep reforming what's new, what's fresh, what's helpful. That's a kind of quick glimpse at a theoretical background. I'm going to invite you to, if you have some responses on that, but more, what I want to do is shift after those comments to saying, let's take a look at how that plays out when we look at some concepts. But any questions about either the definition, now that you've had a little longer time with it, or some marks of discipleship, some features of discipleship aspect that I put before you? Thank you for your graciousness in being along for the ride. We're going to take we have about just a little bit more than a half hour left before we do some wrap up. I want to think about the concept of vocation, you have one, you live one, and that has very much to do in our Christian, from our Christian perspective, with our baptism. But sometimes the toughest part of vocation is figuring out what it really is and what it means. And it's really that aspect I want to look at from a particular angle today. I was very, very, very fortunate as a young adult to choose a college that also chose me, I suppose that's part of the good fortune, for my undergraduate experience. Left for college on my 18th birthday and went to the College of Worcester, which is a Presbyterian college in Ohio. Now, let me say to those of you who are from the Pacific Northwest, Ohio is sort of in the Midwest and sort of in the East. Only after I moved to Minnesota and people thought that was the Midwest did I decide I needed to redefine my own geography to locate where Ohio was in that mix. And what I will say about the College of Worcester, I think many of you have those places from your young adult years, either in a circle of friends, doesn't have to be an institution. Some of you in Holden, Holden's been that kind of place for you over the years, or for many of us with the privilege of higher education, our college years and the whole that went with that, the study of ideas, the particular people who were there as our teachers and our mentors, and then those wonderful peers, thanks to Facebook, the peers we're getting reacquainted with now some years out of college, that created those real lively settings in which to discover who we were and what our life was really going to be about. The College of Worcester, in those days, you had a very, everyone had a faculty advisor, but it wasn't by your major because there was no pressure. In fact, there was a disinclination to have students choose a major for the first 2 years. Go and explore the liberal arts. I think there are different pressures in our world today, different pressures in higher education, but it was a great luxury for me at 18. And my advisor was named Arnie Lewis. Was an art historian. Mm-hmm. And one of the things Arnie said to those of us, there were about 10 advisees in a group, we met weekly with him during our first year. So he said, what I'd really like to encourage you to do is don't choose a major, but when you graduate in 4 years, in those days people generally graduated in 4 years from liberal arts colleges, as you cross the stage at commencement, just holler over your shoulder what your major has been. Now think, I was 18, I was pretty idealistic. I thought that's all it worked. But the freedom in that to explore geology, the first love, English, a second love, history, an emerging love, and then the true love is there was an opportunity to go to Europe on a trip sponsored by the religion department. I accrued a lot of credits. I was a religion major, as I eventually count those up. I was a religion and philosophy major. But I think Arnie was onto something not only about our majors as undergraduates, but about vocation. I want to invite you today to look back over your shoulder to see not what you thought your vocation would be or what you've been telling people for 5 years or 10 years or maybe 35 years, but to take a look in a retrospective way. And to help us think about that, we're gonna look at some literature. And the reason we're gonna make that shift to literature at this midpoint, we're gonna try in the next half hour to do some literature, to talk a bit about faith practices, and to end with scripture, is that I think folks like us have often gotten in a rut where we begin with scripture, and we have sometimes a hard time getting out of the rut. So there is scripture, but it's going to come at the end. Now, I was so fortunate to have one person walk in really early. And she was actually somebody I already knew. And so I was brave enough to ask Maida Carlson. One time we were both at Luther. Maida was a student, and I was There's Dean of Students. You're now a pastor in Minneapolis. I live in St. Paul, and I hardly ever see you. I'm glad I've come to Holden to see you. And Maida and I are going to help with a reading. I have a copy for all of you, but since there was no way to give you an advanced copy, because I didn't know who was going to show up, and I didn't want to squander Wendell Berry on just random people here at Holden. today, for the we're going to do the reading in your presence. And then what I would ask you to do is listen to this as story. How many of you are familiar with Wendell Berry? Fine, fine American author from a very different part of the country called Kentucky, which is a border state to Ohio and that other Midwest. Kentucky is sort of Midwest and sort of South and sort of its own Appalachian reality. Wendell Berry is a farmer. He still farms with horses. He's one of those great lovers of land stewardship, and I doubt that he's been to Holden, but I think he would like very much what the Holden community is about. This story, Jaber Crow, is the long story of a man named Jonah Crow, who is orphaned quite early in his life, and as a young child is sent off to an orphanage after a kind of being orphaned when an aunt and uncle who are raising him also die, grows up his early early adolescence in an orphanage and goes off to a preacher's college to become a pastor because he's been called to do that. And Maida, why don't you come on up and we'll do our reading up here. In this scene, it's things have not gone well for Jonah, who also, will eventually be called Jaber, and he's really wrestling whether he belongs in the preacher's college or if something else is unfolding for him. I went to my professors with my questions, starting with the easiest questions and the talkiest professors. I don't think about them much anymore. I don't hold anything against them. They were decent enough men according to their lights. The problem was they had no doubts. They had not asked the questions that I was asking, and so, of course, they could not answer them. They told me I needed to have more faith, I needed to believe, I needed to pray, I needed to give up my questioning, which was a sign of weakness of faith. Those men could go on all day about the sins of the flesh or the amount of water needed for baptism or whether you could go to heaven without being baptized or who could or couldn't go to heaven, but they couldn't say why if they were taking some of the Bible literally. We don't take all of it literally. Or why we kill our enemies or why we pray standing in the synagogues and in the corners of the street that we may be seen of men. That I should give up my questioning was good enough advice, which I would have been glad enough to take, except that my questioning would not give me up. It kept at me. Sometimes it seemed to me that people I walked by in the street must be able to hear the ding-donging in my head. And so finally, late one afternoon, I went to the professor I was afraid to go to, old Dr. Ardmeyer. I was afraid to go to him because I knew he was going to tell me the truth. Dr. Ardmeyer was a feared man. He was a master of the Greek New Testament, a hard student, and a hard teacher. We believe that he had never given but one A in his life. The number of students in his class in New Testament Greek, which he taught every fall, varied from maybe 20 to maybe 3 or 4 as the horror died away and was renewed. He was known behind his back as Old Grit. I knocked at his open door and waited until he read to a stopping place and looked up from his book.
Come in, Mr. J. Crow.
He didn't like it that I went by my initial. I went in.
Have a seat, please.
Sat down. Customarily, when I came to see him, I would be bringing work that he had required me to talk with him about. That day I was empty-handed. Seeing that I was, he said,
"What have you got in mind?"
"Well," I said, "I got lots of questions."
"Perhaps you would like to say what they are?"
Well, for instance, I said, if Jesus said to love our enemies, and he did say that, didn't he? How can it ever be right to kill our enemies? And if he said not to pray in public, how come we're all the time praying in public? And if Jesus' own prayer in the garden wasn't granted, what is there for us to pray except thy will be done, which there's no use in praying because it will be done anyhow. I sort of ran down. He didn't say anything. He was looking straight at me. And then I realized he wasn't looking at me the way he usually did. I seemed to see way back in his eyes a little gleam of light. It was a light of kindness, and as I now think, of amusement.
Have you any more?
Well, for instance, I said, for it had just occurred to me, suppose you prayed for something and you got it. How do you know how you got it? How do you know you didn't get it because you were going to get it, whether you prayed for it or not? So how do you know it does any good to pray? You would need proof, wouldn't you? But there's no way to get any proof. He shook his head and we looked at each other.
Do you have any answers?
No, I said. I was concentrating so hard looking at him, you could have nailed my foot to the floor, and I wouldn't have felt it. So, I said, I reckon what it all comes down to is, how can I preach if I don't have any answers?
Yes, Mr. Crow, how can you?
He was not one of your frying-sized chicks. I don't believe I can, I said, and I felt my skin turn cold, for I had not even thought that until then.
No, I don't believe you can.
And we sat there and looked at each other again while he waited for me to see the next thing so he wouldn't have to tell me. I oughtn't to waste any time resigning my scholarship and leaving Pigeonville. I saw it soon enough. I said, well, for now I was ashamed. I had this feeling maybe I had been called.
And you may have been right, but not to what you thought, not to what you think. You have been given questions to which you cannot be given answers. You will have to live them out, perhaps a little at a time.
And how long is that going to take?
I don't know. As long as you live, perhaps.
That could be a long time.
I will tell you a further mystery. It may take longer.
He held out his hand to me, and I shook it. As I started to leave, it came to me that of all the teachers I had had in school, he was the kindest. And I turned around. I was going to thank him, but he had gone back to his book. Couple of minutes to think about what vocation means, as Wendell Berry presents it in this novel, The Scene from Jacob Crow. And maybe since I'm guessing most of you have not read the book, has anyone read Jacob Crow? Do you mind saying where his life then leads? What's he end up doing with his life?
Wandering for a while,
mm-hmm.
and coming to a small town and becoming a barber.
Yeah, he goes back to what is functionally his hometown from the childhood he's left as an orphan, and he becomes the town barber, which may in fact be the absolutely best way to be a pastor mm-hmm. in a small town. He's a hearer of everyone's stories and confessions, observer of life, but also in a few remarkable scenes, an incredible truth speaker, more than the local preacher chooses.
He's also a human being. Mm-hmm. He fishes and he mm-hmm. drinks and he mm-hmm. gardens.
Yeah. Anything here in this image of vocation that gives you pause, that either opens up something that maybe you've been thinking about or pushes against something you thought you had nailed down?
I grew up thinking I could never be a pastor or maybe in a church because I had this image and stereotype of people who had it all together and knew all the answers. And it's nice that even his professor said, maybe you don't have all the answers and maybe you have to live into them. And that reminds me of the pointing to the gospel. You don't have to be the gospel. Jesus is being the gospel. And he's got the answers and you can point to it.
Thank you. Other things that either open up for you in a passage like this or that you want to explain?
I think it's interesting as I think that we spend so much time talking about vocation that we don't seem to vocate as much.
Tell me more about that.
We think so much about what we're doing and worrying about doing the right thing and making sure we're listening to God's call or however that. And I can't help but wonder, maybe we should just spend more time doing what we're doing. the value of the work.
Yeah. And worry a little less.
Yeah, worry a little less.
What other things you're thinking about vocation?
Well, I pastored for 20-something years, and then I've had a vocation change.
Share a little of that.
And the vocational change came as a result of realizing there was some disparity between what I was saying I believed and what I was living. And didn't really have some good answers for that. I'm a social worker now, and in my process of things, there have much of what I did as a pastor is what I do now. I have never thought or really bought into the idea that there is a professional ministry. The ministry is just whoever we are, whatever we're doing at the point, and that Christ can use us in that context as we live for him. And so, you know, even though I'm not a pastor now, I still pastor people. I love to teach. I love to interact with people and help people grapple with and let the lights come on as they interact with the text and with Christ. With that. So, yeah, vocation for me has never been about being a professional.
Within a
confined area. And so I appreciate what this gentleman over here said, that we sometimes think so much. We try to segregate it. We allocate it to a particular time and place or role that we play. And being a disciple isn't about world.
That whole of the life.
It's the whole of life, whether it be in the arts or the baking of bread.
Excellent. And if I had brought a copy of the book, it'd be going right to you. I think you will enjoy reading J. Brooke Crowe, because a lot, in some way, your own story, that testimony echoes the experience that Wendell Berry has put down. Thank you. Other ways, in terms of something that opens up for you when you hear this particular passage about vocation, or that presses on something you thought you had figured out about vocation?
Was the author, I take it this is fictional, but it's based on his own life? Is that?
I don't think it's autobiographical. Some of the other writings, Berry would come a little closer. I think Wendell Berry is just he's also a poet, so that astute observer of real life at an incredibly local level, the sort of choosing to live in small communities, particularly rural communities. And so I think it's an observation about that. He's not disinterested in matters of faith. He's pretty much, and maybe he has changed his tune on this, but said he would not worship again in a church as long as we air condition the sanctuary and pave the parking lots. The church has not thought enough about the call of God, and yet much, much, much of his poetry echoes the Psalms. He's a very careful reader of Scripture, and I'm sure many of you caught, even in this two, three pages, the number of scriptural references.
And that's what's kind of interesting, is that he offers some critical questions to Christianity. And he, as a human being, has used the form of the story to really dig underneath our skin to say, why are you standing out in the street or publicly praying? He asks some very tough questions of the church.
I commend him to you as an author. If those would be some of the questions that are kind of on your mind and heart, let's shift gears and take the next little stretch of time to think about your own life and those home folk for you, whatever that community is that you think of as your people in Christ at a local level. If you wanted to do some faith practices that allowed everyone to see the richness of what vocation is, and not just to say, and I don't think any of you would do this, but vocation is something full-time church workers have, and everybody else, good luck to you. I think our sophistication theologically takes us well beyond that at a place like Holden. But if you wanted to create an environment in which persons of all ages were thinking, living into, claiming, having chances to have significant conversation about vocation, about what it is that God had called a particular person to do and be about in the world over a lifetime, what would be some of the things you'd put together? Can you think how you'd shape an environment where vocation could have that kind of richness? Or maybe you're actually from an environment where vocation is more than just a word, it's a kind of way of a way of life. Please.
I would say freedom to explore. I guess I even think of my kids, and they are very free-spirited. Mm-hmm. They go and they're going to do their thing whether or not somebody tells them they can or can't. And as an example, yesterday my 11-year-old son was in the chapel experimenting with the electric guitar, and he figured out a riff. If you heard that in the village, that was Joseph, but he wouldn't have that opportunity at home because we don't have that.
Oh, until you get there now.
But
that openness to go try something.
Right.
And the encouragement to do that.
Yep.
The try out thing.
That, he decided he was going to and he could.
Yeah.
He was just allowed to do that.
Excellent. How about some other faith practices? What would you do? Melinda?
I don't know if it's a faith practice, but we in church life we just stick people in roles because we need to have them done. I mean, what is it to really say to someone, you are free. You are free to let that go. Yes, that job needs to be done. Somehow it'll get done. But what's your hunch about the place you need to be? And I think we really stick it to people and really crush that that questing spirit.
And are you meeting within congregations? We get people busy.
Yeah, I'm a pastor.
Yeah.
I'm talking about church life.
Yeah. So maybe a little different way of thinking about what's going to get done or not get done or who's going to be the doers, even within congregational life, that would actually let the winds of vocational freedom blow through. Okay? Some other thoughts, some early thoughts about faith practices around vocation.
I'd love to live in a place where one of the top three questions people ask you is, what do you do? Especially during a recession where people are losing their jobs and there's shame associated with not having an answer for that question. What's your name? Where are you from? What do you do? And it's hard to watch people not have an answer for that when they've always had an answer for that and taken pride in that. But if you're in a place surrounded with people who want to know who you are and what you do might come up and you might get paid for it and you might not, that would be lovely.
And could it be that now the the economic challenges before us may cause at least communities of faith to actually focus in on how narrow the doing part is of the identity. Mm-hmm. Some other ideas.
I recently was at a birthday party for a 100-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
He retired when he was 26.
Uh-huh.
And it's always been fun to hear what he says when somebody says, "What did you do?"
Uh-huh.
And most recently, I heard him lie. He said, "I work for my brother." He doesn't have a brother. But I thought that was a good answer. He didn't say a thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and your example of a 100-year-old, I think, again, we begin to focus on children. What are you going to do with your life? And again, much of those, say the last 20 years, we have, I think, been kinder to young adults by really giving permission for exploring that and not just at Holden. Holden has a longer than 20-year history, but I think many, many, many of the institutions dealing with young adults have gotten savvier about making that a time of exploration to talk about purpose and meaning in one's life. But to still be in conversation with a 100-year-old about that, think about the over-the-shoulder vocation image, that's fascinating. And I had never thought about just making up stories.
Yeah.
I think I'd practice gratitude and generosity.
And you'd claim that as
faith practice.
As a faith practice around vocation.
A communal opportunity to be generous and grateful to each other and to others beyond the community.
And I want to say this because partly it's been my experience at Holden these first days, to be really grateful for other people who have labored hard at something, because I'm doing hardly anything except showing up and breathing and eating and relaxing and meeting people. But I know there's a staff that's doing work. And I think maybe coming away to a place to see that allows us also back home to think how to be grateful for the people around us whose lives of hard work give shape and form to ours as well. I want to put a seed of an idea before you. If it interests you, you can borrow it because it didn't come in an original way to me and to others who've been part of this. But I want to say it's, again, one of those contextual things. I serve part-time in a congregation called named Gloria Day in St. Paul. We have two morning services on Sunday and one at 5 p.m. And when we added the evening service, which we call the Feast of Eventide, we chose to make the orientation a little bit more toward going out the door and into our real lives in the week. And one of the things we've done for several years now is to end the service with a blessing of the vocation of all the baptized in the world. I would like sometime this coming year to think of a way to ask the people, while there are a variety of people who worship at 5, there's also kind of a core group that are there, whether this has had any earthly effect on them. This little liturgical ritual, the leadership at the end of communion, those who have been the worship leaders all gather at the font, which is in a prominent center aisle, for this kind of back and forth blessing of the faithful. This language is actually taken from the adult catechesis, a Light of Christ program. So if I say to you it's not original, that's its context. And I wonder about that, but I don't want to make it sound like faith practices are things we only do on Sunday within church buildings. Faith practices are largely what we do in our homes that are then reinforced by what we do when we come together as communities of faith for worship. But I share this with you as a sample and invite you, if you can think of a way that you might use this with your own household. Many of you have the blessing of living with others. I say that because I live alone. I have a lot of privileges in that. Peace, quiet, nobody's learning guitar riffs. Nobody's gonna bug me the entire trip home. Couldn't I please have that electric guitar? You can see I have a native gift. That woman, Patricia, told me to just stay on you so I can have a musical career. There are privileges that come with living on one's own, but there's also a great blessing in living with a household. And this might give you an idea how you, as a circle of friends that get together regularly or within your own household, you might also have an at-home ritual about how you live your lives, how we encourage one another to live the whole of our lives pointing to Jesus Christ. Let me do just a quick transition because I've heard the bell and I think that means my stomach thinks it means lunch. Isn't that the next big event here? We are going to close with scripture, but I have such great confidence in you that we're not going to discuss the scripture until we come back together again, and that could be years from now when we're reassembled, or for some of you it would be, I think tomorrow evening is the second session in this series. And I will also set out, for those of you who would like to read ahead, the excerpt of literature that we're going to use tomorrow. You're not required to take one, but I have a stack of copies if you'd like to read ahead on that. But the passage, and if you have a Bible, please turn to Mark 5, 1 through 20. It's one of my favorite discipleship stories. And to some degree, I favor it as a discipleship story because most people would not think of it as, at least as at a first pass, as a discipleship story. It's the healing of the demoniac, the man who is forced to live among the tombs because not even the chains will hold him safe from inflicting hurt upon his own body. And I think many of us in contemporary times could imagine this scene because we also have people we care for dearly where mental illness is so severe that there is no way easily to bind the person. So this is a man living a very isolated life who, and I'm now introducing the story, we're just going to look at a couple of verses in this 5, 1 through 20, who calls out to Jesus, who comes and falls before Jesus, knowing that Jesus will do harm to the demon who is in him. And then it's the fascinating story of those pigs. We could do a whole week-long Bible study just on what are the pigs doing in the story. Economic loss of encountering Jesus if you're the neighboring swineherd. What I want to come down to is all the way to verse 18. It's the tail end of the story. And again, as your homework, you're going to take a little bit longer with this, and we'll begin tomorrow's session with another look at this text. If somebody would read 18 through 20.
As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by demons begged him that he might be with him. But Jesus refused and said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and what mercy he has shown to you." He went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed.
Thank you. What's discipleship look like in this story? That's the question I send you home with. What's discipleship look like? Because we are most often drawn to stories that are about leaving home to follow Jesus. And here we have a story of a man who is sent home. So I would invite you to ponder that. What does discipleship look like for this particular person? And also, who are these friends? What would it mean to go back to such friends after this isolated, socially isolated life that has been the man's life for some period of time? And just imagine your way into that story to think, okay, what is this saying about discipleship? And some of that, as we share it with one another tomorrow, will be our way into the next theme, which is prayer. Here's a copy. It will be Christos. Michael, right at the door, will be holding these if you'd like, or his chair if he steps out. If you want the reading for tomorrow for an advanced read, here it is. It's from Mark Saltzman's Lying Awake. It's an excerpt. Some of you may be familiar with this literature, and it's a couple of pages long. We won't be reading the whole thing together, but a head start for those of you who are. Thank you for being a part of this group.
Thank you.